Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, sir. And our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello and glad tidings.
And also we've got our online editor, Jack Shepherd, fresh off dropping the Matrix review online.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
So today we are going to be counting down our top 20 films of the year. And, you know, there were tears and tantrums as we whittled this list down. And that's just Jack. But here are the top 20 films of 2021. It's the final countdown. So let's kick off then with our rundown of 20 to 10. So at number 20, it's Petit Maman. At 19, it's Shang-Chi. At 18, it's Sensor. At 17, The Most Beautiful Boy in the World. At 16, The Power of the Dog. At 15, Passing. 14, In with a Bullet, No Time to Die. And at 13, First Cow. And 12 is Another Round. And number 11 is Quo Vadis, Aida. So, shall we move on to our 10, boys, and discuss what made the top 10, the must-see movies of this year? At number 10, it's this. If you'd have told me a year ago that I'd be locked inside of my home, I would have told you a year ago, interesting, now leave me alone. Getting up, sitting down, going back to work. So this is Bo Burnham's Inside, his Netflix special documentary that was recorded during lockdown and seemed to be a mirror on all our experience. How did this make our top 10? When, you know, we've had some pretty cinematic events this year, but this was one man and his video recorder. Matthew, what was so special about it?
Well, like you say, I mean, it's kind of a film that could only have been made in this era, in 2020/21. It does really capture the sense of isolation, self-isolation and self-amusement that we've all been caught up in the last year or so, and kind of looking very much inward because there's no other choice thanks to lockdown, but also having a few laughs as well along the way at the kind of absurdity of the whole situation, which he does very well, very creatively. And just proving that no matter what the restrictions, what the limitations, you can make something, you can be creative, you can be resourceful, even in the most tightened of circumstances. I mean, it's so impressive the way he pulled all this together by himself, you know, writing, directing, performing, and doing all this jazzy lighting as well. I mean, lighting.
Is there anything you can't do?
I know.
Is there anything you can't do?
It's quite annoying, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but also not to sound too wanky, but it is also about a journey, a mental health journey as well in this, isn't it? It really, you know, he's obviously heightening it for the purposes of the film, but, you know, talking about the serious sort of stress people were under during lockdown and still are, and how that affects you from a mental health point of view. So from that point of view, it kind of felt important as well as frivolous. What did you think, Jack?
I was just really impressed by how it started off, like, outright very, very funny. And the songs were just humorous. And then suddenly it kind of takes this slightly darker turn, doesn't it? Especially kind of around the midpoint, and starts getting into these bigger issues. Even, you know, talking about our relationship with the internet and, you know, these kind of refrains on Jeff Bezos and stuff. Like, they're funny, but at the same time, it is just like, God, we are relying on Amazon a lot right now. This is quite depressing. It's not just like a comedy special, is it? It's so much more than that. You know, I am infinitely jealous of his talents and, you know, going from Eighth Grade, which is another movie I really love, into this, which kind of, you know, harkens back to his roots as a YouTuber. And now it's like, well, where's he going to go next? You know, I'm excited to see whatever he does, even if it was something else like this. Although I think, you know, there was only one opportunity to do this kind of film and he seized it. And it worked really, really well. So I think, you know, as a kind of one-off little gem that encapsulates like our time, it's just, yeah, really great.
Did you like it, Matt?
I did, yeah. And I just love the songs as well. I mean, it's weird because
White Woman's Instagram.
Obviously, Yeah, and it's so like there's so much going on, and it's kind of so cleverly done, and obviously with all the lighting and the restrictions and all that kind of stuff. But just even the songs are just like the best. I would say it's almost the best musical of the year, even though you wouldn't necessarily think of it as a musical, but just the songs are just kind of so funny, but yet also profound and also just really kind of catchy and getting in your head. So he's just annoyingly talented, yeah. And I mean, the 30 song made me feel quite depressed when he was kind of bemoaning turning 30. And I was like, come on, mate, you've achieved so much more than me and have so much more talent than me. So how am I supposed to feel?
Yeah. And don't forget, he's also really excellent in Promising Young Woman. It's like he's not only doing this in his bedroom, he's actually acing it everywhere.
Yeah. Cheers, Bo.
So that is Bo Burnham. And if you haven't seen it yet, please do go and see it on Netflix. It's Inside, and probably, unfortunately, still incredibly pertinent to the times we live in. We thought it wasn't. We thought maybe we were getting beyond that, but it probably is still very pertinent. Shall we move on and see what made our number nine?
Yeah.
We're the Mitchells, the only people who can save the world. I'm super sorry, everyone.
So this is Mitchells versus the Machines, one of many voice acting roles for Olivia Colman this year. She is playing a sort of evil digital thing in this film. Tell us about it, Matt. You like a bit of animation. Why is this one winning above all the rest that came out this year?
Well, it is produced by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who produced Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and then they directed the 21 Jump Street films and loads of other stuff. And it's got all that kind of visual invention and sort of meta humor. And on one level, it's just eye-bogglingly kind of like beautiful to look at, just the designs, the sort of textures. But then I also thought this was genuinely possibly the funniest film of the year in terms of just the consistency of the laugh rate, because you have this story is basically around this family, and this sort of older daughter is getting ready to go to college, and basically all hell breaks loose on the journey there, where kind of the technology takes over the world, like this AI technology sort of takes over the world, and every kind of bit of tech gets possessed. I just loved all the jokes, the action, the characters as well. There's some kind of touching sort of family moments in there. There's something for everyone to relate to. I think you get all these really funny kind of Swedish home videos that the girl Katie makes, a lot of them featuring Munchie the pug.
And yes, the pug is excellent.
I just thought it was just ridiculously funny, ridiculously well done. And the kind of film I just wanted to keep pausing to sort of like examine the frames and everything, you know, because the Swedish element of the films that Katie makes kind of bleeds out into the film itself a bit. And it's got this kind of scrappy sketchbook quality. And it really feels like one of those films that embraces being animated and just does what only an animated film could do, and leans into that rather than trying any kind of semblance of realism. And it's just delightful.
It is. And it's another dig at a sort of Amazon boss type, Steve Jobs type figure again, isn't it? Which again, we're all relying on, and our reliance on technology again in these times we live in, really taking a stab at that and what that means, and what that means for humanity if we only talk to our phones, which I found quite profound as well. Matthew, why do you think this popped the top 10 where, you know, Luca and other things didn't?
Yeah, it's hard to say, really. I suppose because it does just resonate with us, with all the themes of family and how we use domestic technology. It feels very pertinent. And it's also similar to Ron's Gone Wrong, which also has Olivia Colman doing a voice role, where that felt quite derivative, and you kind of spend the film kind of ticking off the films it resembles. This one felt a lot fresher and a lot more pertinent, more modern. And yeah, it's so much more stuffed with gags. It's so much just sharper and fresher. So I think that's why it stands out, really. It's the only animated film of the last 50 years not to have any songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda in it. So,
well, there is that, yes. I know. Talking about talented people, I think Bo Burnham and Lin-Manuel could just have a sit down in 2022, don't you? I mean, you've done enough, gentlemen.
With J.K. Simmons, because he's been in everything this year as well.
And Olivia Colman. I mean, could you just all stop being so talented and just have a little rest? Because it's depressing how much I've achieved in comparison, i.e. nothing. Okay, so that is Mitchells vs. the Machines at number 9. It's time for number 8 then. And this is a film that's had staying power despite coming out at the beginning of the year.
How's your daddy like that new farm? He growing things good, doing things right?
Yes.
This is Minari, which did well in award season at the beginning of the year, so it feels like it's been around a while. So why has it got the staying power, Jack? Why has this one made the top 10, even though it came out so early in the year?
It's just a very interesting kind of study of this family. So it's about a Korean family who have moved from California to Arkansas, and the father figure, played by Steven Yeun, is kind of driving this move, and he wants to be a farmer and for them to succeed and live the American dream. And it's not the promised land he wanted it to be. And it's this look at this family who are kind of like struggling through all these hardships and really trying to make it and live this better life. And it's kind of grounded by these amazing performances. Yoon Yoo-jung won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for this role. She kind of came into the movie as this mother figure coming over from Korea to America, and she has this bond with the child of the family, who's also excellent.
Alan Kim.
I mean, they were all completely delightful at awards season. And I think just the pertinence of the movie, you know, it's interesting what's been doing well recently, kind of like on a pop culture level. And I guess one of the more obvious examples is kind of Squid Game, also a Korean series on Netflix, but very much kind of like people who are hard done by, kind of trying to make it in a very capitalist society. And this movie kind of touches on all of that. And I think the themes of it have just resonated with everyone and have lasted through. It's just a really nice, kind of like quite minimal, good movie. What did you guys think?
Well, I never knew about chicken sexing, so I enjoyed learning about that in the first place. Did you guys know that that was even an occupation and that people literally picked up a tiny chick and looked at its bum and put it in a different crate? So for my money, I was already educated there. But on a serious note, I just found it really immersive as well. I really felt like I understood this family, even though I've never been to Korea and I've never eaten the delicious foods and the stinky things that grandma's brought on the plane that, you know, the little boy sort of saying, I don't want to eat that because it's weird. And I want to have this lunch that's American when I go to school. I just felt I really understood them from the script and the way that the actors portrayed them. And I loved it. I wanted to spend more time with them and grow some Minari in a river somewhere. I want to taste that. What does that taste like? Going to a Korean supermarket tomorrow, I think, might be on my mission. What did you think?
Yeah, I really liked it. Yeah, I mean, the performances are just delightful, especially Yoon Yoo-jung, who was just a delight on the awards circuits as well. I mean, you wanted her to win just to hear what she was going to say in her speeches. I mean, she was fantastic at the Oscars and at the BAFTAs as well. And she just absolutely steals this film. And Steven Yeun, I mean, he's very understated in comparison, but you really do feel for him. It's such an empathetic performance and such a kind of slow burning, lovely little film, really, that everyone can relate to.
Yeah, I mean, and there's always going to be new families trying to make it in America, aren't there? You don't have to be Korean to understand this struggle. You don't have to be American to understand this struggle of, you know, trying to do the best for your family. It really is a sort of universal film. And from that point of view, I guess that's why it's made the top 10, where newer things, flashier things, I'm talking about Spider-Man, which was further down the list. So that is Minari at number 8. In at number 7, then, it's this.
Things are dried up here for me.
Oh! Yeah!
There's an opportunity.
Where?
London.
This will be our fourth move in 10 years.
Backwards.
But money's fine, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. This is a fresh start.
So this is The Nest, the story of an American family in the 80s who comes to live in London, and the fallout of that move from a monetary and social and familial point of view. Matt, did you like this one? You like Kubrick, and I think this is quite Kubrickian.
Yeah, there's something sort of austere and chilly about it, and I did absolutely love this film. And I would say perhaps this is, of the films in our top 10, this is perhaps the one that got the least attention, maybe, sort of widely. I don't feel like it was perhaps that widely seen and, you know, didn't get perhaps quite the sort of credit it deserved. But this is another kind of interesting little film set in the 80s And you've got this English guy, Rory, played by Jude Law, who lives in New York with his sort of American family. He's sort of like a trader. He's in some kind of financial business. And basically he gets this opportunity to move back to the UK to sort of start working with someone he knows. And he kind of takes this opportunity thinking it's going to be the thing that's going to sort of change all their lives and going to be this kind of secret to his future success. And then they move into this kind of weird sort of old mansion almost. It's sort of, there's something a bit creepy about it, very kind of big. They rattle around in it a bit. And then from there, it's kind of just what happens to the family, really. And I mean, I wouldn't go too deep into it because I imagine there's probably a lot of people that haven't seen it and hopefully might, after seeing its placement on the list, think, wow, that's something I should catch up on before the year's out. But you just basically follow Roy and his wife, Alison, who's played by Carrie Coon, who you might have seen in Ghostbusters Afterlife this year. And what happens to their relationship as Rory kind of continues chasing this dream, and it's kind of starts to become evident that, you know, it's not kind of quite going to plan as he would like it. And she's clearly getting a bit fed up with the situation. And it's just this kind of fascinating dynamic about what kind of happens to the family in those circumstances. And it's one of those films that there's not loads of kind of, you know, there's not loads of explosive stuff happens. There's a sort of a weird, creepy bit with a horse, and there's some, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And there's obviously another horror scene of like a teenage party in the house, which obviously kind of terrified me. But there's not loads of kind of huge set pieces. But yeah, it's just one of those films that really kind of gets under your skin and really sort of stays with you. Like, did you guys like it as well?
I placed this really high on my list. And I loved as well the fact that, you know, Jude Law, he went through a period of time where he was doing things that weren't that great. And then suddenly, you know, he comes back and he's doing really interesting projects. And even, you know, his young Dumbledore is really interesting to me. And I sort of, this film really made me remember what a great actor he is, how much I love him in Closer and things like that. And this sort of reminded me of that film in the sort of, it really exposes the dynamics between people in relationships. And Carrie Coon is so good in this, and she's just amazing anyway, but she's just really brilliant in this. And it really is a sort of study for me, although it sort of centers on Rory, the study is of her. And she's not just the wife at home, she is trying to keep the family together and trying to do that without any sort of tools at her disposal, because he doesn't allow her any. And this sort of portrait of how women sort of keep a family together and do a lot of emotional work in family dynamics like that, where the man thinks that he has to go out and sort of provide for the family and provide big as well, this absolute pressure he's put on himself. And they've sort of burnt the candle at both ends. It's just fascinating and really relatable. I think we can all relate to certain elements of that. And, you know, the job that you think was going to be amazing and it turned sour, you know, the move that didn't quite work out, the house you bought that was an absolute bugger. Why did we buy this? All of those things are sort of wrapped up in this. And it's so, so good. I wish more people had seen this, but it did, as you say, seem to sort of creep out under the radar. But yeah, just fantastic film.
It's Sean Durkin's big comeback after Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, his first film in 10 years. He did feel like it should have been much more of a story, because he, you know, he really proved he wasn't a one-hit wonder, and he came back with something that's so different from his first film. But yeah, you know, equally as compelling and fascinating, with great performances. So yeah, it really feels like this needs to be seen more by people.
Jack, you're going to watch it?
It's on my watch list. It's been there for ages since I heard everyone raving about it. So
yeah, we talked about it loads and you just didn't bother to see it. Why?
To be honest, I didn't know it was, I realized it was out, to be honest.
We did a feature on it, like Jamie Graham interviewed everyone for it, yeah, and did a great feature. But then even I was surprised when it came in cinemas, because then it was just suddenly one day, I was just like, walked past the cinema, I was like, oh, it's out today. Like,
and then it was gone.
Like, it came with no fanfare. It didn't feel like, you know, there was loads of kind of big reviews or anything like that. You know, it just did seem to creep out very quietly.
But Carrie Coon, you know, really deserved to be in the awards conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, her performance fabulous. She's so good, so nuanced. Says so much with the way she holds a drink at a party, just her physical, you know, like you can tell how furious she is the way she sips a drink. She's just incredible in this. So, yeah, I hope that more people view it, especially as it is our number seven.
it does feel like a film that's going to grow in time, like with the sort of, you know, gain that sort of cult status.
Yep. So that is The Nest. Let's move on to number six then.
Date of birth?
Friday, 31st of December, 1937.
You're living with your daughter at the moment?
Yes, until she goes to live in Paris.
No, Dad, why do you keep going on about Paris?
You told me.
No, I didn't.
I'm sorry, Anne, you told me the other day. Have you forgotten? She's forgotten. Paris. They don't even speak English there.
So this is the father, another Olivia Colman starer. She's everywhere. This is also another film that was awards season darling and so came out early, but has held its place in our affection throughout the year. Matt, why?
Probably Anthony Hopkins' performance is perhaps why it's kind of held its own so much. Obviously, he won the Oscar for it, kind of sort of controversially beating Chadwick Boseman, who was kind of considered the favourite in the run-up to it. He is an astonishing performance from Anthony Hopkins, and I feel that you can't begrudge him the win in this case, because he's basically playing a sort of an elderly gentleman, also called Anthony, and he's living in a flat. And it's really interesting because obviously, you know, if you had to put it simply, it's kind of like a dementia drama where he's kind of dealing with this. But the way it's presented is kind of so different to how I've seen it in any film really before. And it's sort of directed by Florian Zeller, who's kind of adapted it from his own stage play. And I felt like it escaped a lot of the problems that stage adaptations have. I mean, it is restricted largely to one location, which is this flat. But it really works because the way things, like, you're really put into it in his perspective. So little things and big things change, like within the flat and within his experience of the people kind of coming to visit him. So unlike any film I've seen that kind of tackled this sort of subject matter before, it really puts you into his position and gives you a sense of what that kind of disorientation would be like. And then also on top of that, it also sort of plays almost like a mystery in a lot of ways, because you have these people coming to visit him and he sometimes can't remember who they are, or someone different turns up claiming to be someone that he's not convinced that they are who they say they are. So it also has this sort of almost like mystery thriller element to it, where you're just not really sure what's going on. You don't know who to trust. You don't know exactly what's happening. It's really, really gripping in that sense. And then it sort of leads to an extremely sort of moving ending as well, a kind of, you know, how it all ends up playing out and how it ends up being revealed. Yeah, a really, really great film. I love this film.
Yeah, spoilers. This was my number one pick, I think, for the year.
Was it?
Yeah, I thought it was superb. I found it very upsetting in the way only movies can make you feel. I think Anthony Hopkins just steals the show, doesn't he? He's so phenomenal in this. And Olivia Colman as his daughter, Cara. And the way, you know, the timelines within the movie kind of change and interweave, and it's done in just such a clever way. And it's really disorientating in, you know, when someone goes into one room and then they go into the other and then they go back into that one and the decor's changed or because the decade's changed or something like that. And I mean, at times it feels like a horror movie almost. You know, Anthony Hopkins can be quite terrifying at moments. It's just phenomenal. He kind of like swings and it's just very well done. And yeah, I was quite blown away by it because this was my last Oscars movie, because this was obviously last awards season. I remember it was the last one I watched. I was gearing up to cover the Oscars all night for Total Film. And this was the last one I watched like just beforehand. And I was just like quite shaken by it. Just like, wow, this is phenomenal. Now I've got to stay up all night watching the Oscars. but it did mean that I had definitely a big appreciation for it. Hopkins winning that Best Actor award, because it was, I mean, that award ceremony was completely geared up towards Chadwick winning, you know, the last kind of announcement of the night. Very odd choice in itself.
Odd choice of presenter as well. They had old Joaquin Phoenix shuffle on looking like he wanted the ground to swallow him up. Everyone expecting it's going to be Chadwick, and then it's Anthony, and he hadn't even bothered coming. He didn't think he was going to win. What a cock up in general. But it is very well deserved, isn't it? I mean, you know, obviously Chadwick did a superlative performance as well, but he hasn't been robbed by Anthony Hopkins for this.
No, it's an interesting, you know, companion piece to his other Oscar-winning movie, Silence of the Lambs, as well, where he's kind of this very terrifying, horrific figure who's very over the top and big and kind of just very big performance. And this is almost understated in the way he plays certain things. You know, there are so many nuances in what he does. So yeah, the two of them, I imagine, would be quite a back-to-back viewing. But yeah, no, definitely well-deserved for him.
I also think it's really good that if you've ever experienced anyone with dementia, the rage and the anger that he goes through is so horribly true of that condition, because you're furious. Like, why are people moving your stuff around? Because your brain isn't telling you the information that you need to know. And I thought it was just really well done in showing not only the sufferer's position in this, but also the carer, when you're trying to care for someone who is, you know, raging against you because they think you're lying, or and the sadness that comes with that and the hurt. I think Olivia Colman did a magnificent job of sort of showing that experience as well. And hopefully, you know, you do watch it and feel like you want to give your loved ones a squeeze at the end of it and not just feel completely depressed. You need your tissues at that ending, don't you?
Oh, yeah, gotcha.
Okay, let's move on to number five, the halfway point. And it's another one that stood the test of time.
Every week, I go to a club. I act like I'm too drunk to stand. And every week, a nice guy comes over to see if I'm okay.
You okay?
You are so pretty. I am a nice guy.
Are you?
One, two, three, four.
So this is promising young woman, Emerald Fennell's searing sort of takedown of date rape and toxic masculinity. Again, another one that came out earlier in the year, did well in the awards season, but has still charted high in our list. Why, Matthew? Why?
Because it's brilliant. That's why.
It is brilliant.
Word. It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I saw this years and years and years ago. like, it's one of the last films I saw pre-lockdown. But yeah, it certainly has stayed with me. And it's, yeah, it's just amazing to see it. Emerald Fennell was better known as being Camilla in The Crown, making a writer-director debut here. She won the Best Original Screenplay for her brilliant screenplay. It's quite interesting to contrast it with the trailer, because the trailer is quite lurid and garish, and it kind of leads you to expect one type of film, which this isn't really. It kind of goes in many different directions. You expect it to be a kind of more sort of straightforward revenge black comedy thriller. But there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more subtlety and nuance to it. And a lot of that it does owe to Carey Mulligan's performance as Cassie, who's a very complicated character. You can't take your eyes off her throughout the movie. And it also has Bo Burnham in it as well, who we talked about earlier. He's very good. And it's just some absolutely brilliant twists and turns. I mean, the ending's incredibly bold as well, without giving anything away.
Which wasn't the ending that she was going to go with. She was going to go for an even bleaker ending. But the studio talked her into doing that final coda on it.
Yeah.
Because they were just like, why would anyone watch this film? Because actually, it's really depressing. And, you know, in light of news reports that we've seen this year, it is really a depressing subject, you know, the sort of abuse of women. But in her hands, what a, as you say, thriller to watch, because she wrong foots at every turn. And even her choice of music is, you weren't expecting that. I mean, who thought that they would be earwormed by Paris Hilton?
Yeah, she really pulls it off. I mean, it is kind of the movie of the Me Too era, and kind of follows things like Bombshell and The Assistant. But I mean, it's even better than those, I would say, because it just conjures so many moods. I mean, it is just, it's funny, it's upsetting, it's exhilarating, it's uncomfortable. It's just, yeah, it's just a phenomenal piece of work. And it has really just stood the test of time, like you said, you know, because it has been around for such a long time. So it's real validation that it picked up major awards. So all power to Emerald.
Yeah, I loved it as well. Yeah, just to add, it's sort of one that it was surprisingly sort of funny in a lot of places as well. Just certain things it kind of captured and nailed, like weirdly sort of darkly funny, despite it being sort of this grim subject matter and a sort of important talking point. It was just very, very entertaining to watch. And I also love the way that they cast all the sort of sleazy guys in it against type in a way that they're sort of people you perhaps recognize from TV shows or other sort of romantic comedies or sort of teen comedies and that sort of thing. They're sort of doing things that perhaps might have been sort of laughed at in other American Pie style films some of the time, but kind of, you know, showing you how kind of, you know, morally reprehensible a lot of that was, you know, and how just weird things were just gotten away with in the past. So I love this film.
It avoids being lectury at all, you know, where a movie about kind of this sort of subject could veer into kind of talking at the audience or something like that. This doesn't do that. It kind of, it's just very engaging and does it in a very clever way that, as you said, is both horrendous but also darkly funny at times. And, you know, again, just annoyed at Bo Burnham for being great in this as well. So
and singing all the lyrics to Stars Are Blind whilst dancing around a pharmacy, knowing them all, like a true, you know, feminist that he appears to be in this. Also, I love the look of this as well, the sort of candy coloured existence of Cassie and the fact that she's sort of she's every sort of fantasy as you know, this girl that has this long blonde hair, sort of Britney hair, and dresses in these little sort of infantilized outfits, but is actually this deadly serious woman who is weaponizing her sexuality and is so damaged. There's, you know, everybody in this is damaged in some way or another, either by the way that they've been brought up to expect things to happen, or, you know, being the victim of things that happen. I think it's a brilliant conversation starter.
All the bit parts are great as well. Like, you've got Alison Brie, Molly Shannon, Clancy Brown, Laverne Cox. I mean, it is one of those films that's top to bottom stuffed with talent.
Jennifer Coolidge. I love Jennifer Coolidge in this. She's so sort of sad, and so it's sort of like the role she plays in White Lotus, but not, she's not playing it as much for laughs, but it is sort of very wryly funny. There was just, everybody is cracking. It's a absolutely gold-plated five-starer of a film, and that is Promising Young Woman, which is number 5. Shall we find out what's at number 4?
Hear you. Do you understand me? I can't. I'm deaf. I'm deaf.
So this is Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed starring as a drummer who loses his hearing suddenly and how that impacts his life. Amazing sound design on this film. Really interesting script and great performances again. But what else is really good about it, Jack?
I mean, Riz kind of anchors the whole thing, doesn't he? His reactions to kind of becoming hard of hearing and deaf through his years and years of drumming and the struggles that kind of come with that. You know, the fact that he's lost the one thing he really truly loves in music. And then you also have his partner, Olivia Cook, who is also really, really great in the part, but also has a lot of complicated things that kind of unfurl. You know, they're supposed to be this kind of like hippie, cool touring pair who are in a band together. And then you find out things about her upbringing and stuff that are actually kind of counter to that. And there's a lot of really great story beats in it and kind of like things that are the antithesis of one another. And Riz is the highlight here because he is just so, so good. And as you said, the sound editing as well is just phenomenal. The way they actually play him and how he loses his hearing, and the best shot for me was the last one in the movie, which I obviously don't want to spoil, but it's this really big moment for him as a character, and really just you feel the struggles and how he got to this point and the kind of almost relief there as well. It's just done. I know Matt absolutely loved this one as well.
You saw this at a festival long time ago.
I did, yeah. This was one of those, talking about films that have been knocking around for a while, I saw this at TIFF in September 2019, and it was one of those things that it was the great part of the festival experience where you can just go into a film knowing virtually sort of nothing about it and just be just completely sort of absorbed and blown away by it. And I've seen it a few times since then as well, and just each time I've just loved it. And it was my personal number one choice for the film of this year. I've talked a lot about it on various podcasts for us over the past
12
months.
Over the years since you've seen it. It's just years now.
Yeah, like I say, it's just so engrossing, partly because of that sound design. Riz Ahmed, I would say, is kind of best performance yet, which is kind of, sort of saying something, deservedly Oscar nominated. Also really deserved, I think, was Paul Racy, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, who plays his kind of mentor, this sort of rehab facility where that's a place for deaf addicts. And he just has such gravitas. He just feels like such a kind of wise mentor figure that, you know, you just kind of hang off his every word and you really believe he's kind of lived all this and knows what he's talking about.
But
you
know, he has in a way, isn't he? Because Paul Racy is the child of deaf parents. So he does understand this sort of element that he's playing. It's not just an actor just turning up to learn sign language. This is really ingrained in him.
Yeah, he's really sort of steeped in this culture. Talking of like moving moments, that's one of the most moving moments for the year is when Ruben decides, you know, to leave, where he kind of goes off to get his implants at that kind of point in the film. And then he kind of comes back, and just the conversation they have at the kitchen table there, I just find that sort of heartbreaking. And yeah, it's one of those films that it genuinely leaves me feeling like profoundly changed after I've watched it. I feel like a bit kind of knocked out by it. So that for me is why it's my number one film of the year. Just nothing's had that sort of impact on me this year. Yeah, what a film.
What a film, indeed. And that final scene that Jack mentioned is, yeah, it really does make you think about self-acceptance, and everybody in the audience can relate to, you know, that idea of learning to accept what you can't change and learning to love yourself. It sounds like it's a film that's really about the struggle, but it's also really about the beauty of life, isn't it? That even when things go wrong, there's loveliness to discover. And that is a really wonderful thing to watch. So that is Sound of Metal, which is our number four. Only three left to go. And it's this one next.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am. I know.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
So Chloe Zhao has had two films out this year. One of them didn't make our top 10, and one of them did, and it's Nomadland. Tell us about it.
This is Nomadland, which is based on a non-fiction book. And at heart, it's basically about a woman called Fern, played by Frances McDormand, who, of course, won the Oscar and virtually every other award going for her performance in this. It's in 2011, around the time of a financial crash, and it sort of looks at people who basically have their lifestyles become untenable due to the financial crash. You know, the work isn't what they had before, you know, and what they do is to make ends meet. And they just basically adapt their lives to the situation by getting in a van and just traveling, working where they can find work in sort of seasonal jobs, Amazon and other places, and just constantly on the move, living in literally a small van with just, you know, that's all their possessions in that small van, sleeping in the back, toileting in the back in a bucket.
Yes, alarmingly so. That happens quite early on, isn't it? You wouldn't think that you would get an Oscar for a role that required you to poo into a bucket loudly, but there you go.
That's what it takes.
And we just get a glimpse into her life, basically traveling around, you know, with these other community of nomads that she runs into at various different points, and this sort of slice of her life. And we learn a little bit along the way about what her life was like before and why she ended up in this position. And similar to Chloe Zhao's previous film, The Rider, if you've seen that, where that basically kind of was almost like a strange blur of fiction and non-fiction, where it was a sort of fictionalized story, but they used real people who'd experienced, you know, very similar things to what the characters go through. So it was this sort of strange blend of documentary and fiction. But here you've got this fictional character in the center, played by Frances McDormand, but then she's very largely surrounded by sort of a lot of real nomads and, you know, people who've really experienced this kind of lifestyle. You do still get that sort of fascinating blend here. And again, it's one of those films that I found crept up on me quite slowly almost. And then by the end, I was totally kind of knocked out by it. And similar, like I didn't like it quite as much as Sound of Metal, my number one film, but I had a similar sort of feeling afterwards where I did feel like, whoa, that I've really experienced, you know, a different kind of culture. I've really sort of changed the way I see certain things. And really feel like I've, you know, to use the cheesiest phrase imaginable, been on a journey like with this character. Yeah, it's a sort of, you know, a very powerful piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it as well. And I think one of the reasons it connected to me when I saw it was because we'd all been in lockdown, and this is about travel and no boundaries and seeing beautiful sunsets in the Badlands in, you know, South Dakota and all of that. So if just from a travelogue point of view, it's a beautiful film and the cinematography is just gorgeous. But equally, as you say, I love those extra people that were real nomads. I love Swanky, this real woman who sort of travels around with this community, and that Frances McDormand was just sort of dropped in with her and Linda, another one of the women who was a real nomad. So it just felt so authentic, so real from that point of view, that you just, again, felt that you really understood these people. And it made me want to go and travel in a van. I know that the minute I was pooing in a bucket, I would be over it completely. But the idea that I think a lot of people, you know, like the idea of the freedom of it, you just pack your stuff and you've got everything you need on your back. You're like a little turtle and off you go. And nobody can pin you down. You can go wherever you want, go where the summer jobs are, you can enjoy sunsets sitting out the back of your van. It's a wonderful idea. But then obviously this does show the hardships of that, that there are people who fall through the cracks of that system, that if your car breaks down, you're buggered, that it's really cold sleeping in North Dakota or Nebraska when you're beet picking and you don't have central heating. The whole experience of this lifestyle is explored here, and it's fascinating. Did you want to get in a van, Jack?
I mean, I do love the idea of going traveling in a van, yeah, for sure. But I enjoyed this movie, but I wasn't wholly blown away by it. But I do think the most interesting aspect is the kind of quasi-documentary style that Chloé Zhao has kind of done so well. I mean, I thought The Rider was a superior film. You know, I think that film's incredible, and I still think this one's very good, as I said. But, you know, this idea of kind of blending fiction with reality, I think, is something we're probably going to see way more of going into the future.
Loads.
You know, the idea of having someone like Bob Wells, YouTube personality, kind of come into this film and kind of be part of it and kind of just speaking as himself and interacting. You know, it feels so authentic. You can't escape that feeling of like, this is how it is. It really does feel that way. And even though it's kind of this fictional film, I think my slight issue with it, therefore, is that sometimes I do wish I was watching a documentary and I knew what the truth was.
Yeah, and so, that's how I felt.
You know, you kind of do get lost in the movie, though. And when you kind of put that to the side and you just kind of become absorbed by it and by Fern, the central character, you know, it really does kind of like take off and become its own. And, you know, the cinematography in it is lovely as well. It just, you know, these sweeping vistas and kind of just traveling around America. You know, when we were really locked inside when this came out and we were watching it, you know, early this year, late last year, it really was kind of like an escape.
So from one escape to another, it's time for our penultimate film. At number two, it's this.
Greatest of kings, let one of your knights try to land a blow against me. Indulge me in this game.
I will beat thee.
So this is The Green Knight, Matt. Who's The Green Knight? And we waited ages for this, didn't we? And then come out. It was worth the wait, though, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, because it was supposed to be coming out in cinemas. I can't remember exactly which month it was. And then suddenly just disappeared for no real kind of explicable reason. And thankfully, it was then a couple of months later, it was sort of picked up by Amazon and had a kind of dual cinema and Prime Video release. So we did get to see it. And there was the option to see it on the big screen if you wanted to. This was one of my favourite films of the year. It was possibly, I don't know. It was in my top three of the year, at least. So I'm very happy to see it where it is on the list. Yeah, the Green Knight is this kind of weird tree creature, and how he sort of figures into the story is he comes to Camelot one day with this kind of invitation for anyone to kind of have a go at attacking him, with the promise that he'll sort of return the favor like 1 year hence. And the person who does kind of take up his sword is Gawain or Garwin or Gawain.
They say it several different ways throughout the film.
Take your pick, whatever you fancy. Played by Dev Patel, and he's this sort of, you know, unsavory sort of young knight and nephew of King Arthur. And he just, you know, thinks, right, I'm going to go for it, chops his head off. And then the Green Knight gets up, picks his head up, walks off, you know, with the threat, right, I'm coming back for your head in a year's time. And so then the film as a whole, we're sort of following it on Gawain's sort of journey, both literal and metaphorical, as he sort of, you know, goes on this sort of picaresque adventure, running into all these different strange fantasy characters and oddballs and a talking fox.
Who doesn't love a talking fox?
I mean, who doesn't, yeah. As he wanders this sort of craggy landscape over the sort of course of a year, basically, you know, trying to sort of see if he can become the sort of knight. And I don't know, it's just about him kind of finding honor, him becoming ready for that death that's been sort of promised him. And it's sort of right up to the sort of ambiguous ending. There's so much to sort of read into this film. That's one of the things I sort of like so much about it. I really came away thinking, one, I wanted to watch it again almost immediately. And I really just wanted to read as much as I could about it and find, like, you know, any interviews about it, read about the original kind of medieval poem that it was inspired by. There's things like, you know, Alicia Vikander has a supporting role in it, but she actually has two supporting roles. And so there you're sort of thinking,
what does it mean?
About,
oh, what,
yeah,
does
what does it mean? Are these characters linked? Are they? Is it just random? Is it just, you know, him being efficient and kind of making the most out of their time?
Someone or, not turn up on the day.
Yeah, is he? Or is he kind of, you know, connecting these two characters? There was so much to kind of think about. I loved it on that level. It felt very sort of, I mean, to use a sort of wanky word,
but
it felt
very
experiential and also kind of literary as well at the same time, where it felt like, felt dirty and earthy. And sort of you really felt like Dev was sort of being put through the ringer physically. But then at the same time, yeah, there was something very literary and sort of poetic about it and like open to interpretation. Even the fact, like, we kind of led to believe that, you know, this is King Arthur, who is played by Sean Harris. But even then, he's only ever referred to as King, I believe, in the film. Like, they don't ever spell out this is King Arthur. So there's just so much that's open to interpretation. But then it also does feel kind of like big scale sort of fantasy at the same time as well. Like, you get these kind of giants and odd creatures and fights. I just loved it.
What did you interpret about it, Jack?
I felt like we were waiting for this movie for years because it just like kept being delayed. And then when it finally came, I think I was slightly blown away by it, and especially some of the visuals. Like, there's a specific bit in the middle when he's kind of on these journeys, he sees these big giants kind of walking off in the distance. And I was just like, whoa, this is really cool. I'm really like excited to see what's happening and how he kind of plays with the mythology of, you know, the Arthurian legend as well, without having to go into specifics, you know, kind of like nods towards, oh, is that character Merlin? Is this blah, blah, blah. You know, it's done really well. And, you know, Dev kind of goes on this journey through it and meets all these really good kind of characters, very characterful characters, like Barry Keoghan's in it for all of 5 minutes, but he makes a real impression as this kind of, he's an actor,
a scallywag, isn't he?
I mean, he has like serious chaos energy anyway, and he kind of comes in and brings that immediately in this very, you know, short role. And then, you know, even like Joel Edgerton's in it for a minute, you know, it's all held together again by this kind of central journey. I think David Lowery is just a really exciting director. I mean, I really, really loved A Ghost Story as well. Mm. And I think, you know, this is like a very kind of more straightforward fantasy adventure. That's like, if that tickles you at all, then it's like just a movie that really works on that level, on like that very simplistic level as well, of just kind of going on that adventure. But then, as Matt was saying, you know, you kind of look into it and dive deeper, and there are so many layers there as well. And, you know, it's got the kind of look of, you know, these kind of like A24 films that are coming out at the moment, and they've really kind of like latched on to something and kind of just nailed it. And I'm really excited to see like what they're doing. I mean, we just saw the trailer for the Northman.
Yeah.
That kind of has that similar visual fantasy style as well. And it's just like, yeah, like, let's do this. This now I'm like super excited for that film as well. And I think they're just on such a winning streak.
Yeah, I mean, this is an audacious film in as much as it tonally, it's very difficult to nail this, isn't it? I mean, it could all go a little bit the Knights of Neep and into the absurd. it's borderline Monty Python, this, isn't it? With a knight picking up his own head and saying, see you in a year, and off he goes. I mean, I was almost expecting coconut clopping to happen, but it's just done tonally, strikes the right balance so perfectly. This casting is great as well. This isn't stuffy. This is really interesting people playing really interesting roles because they're the right person for that role and not because of an idea of what, you know, this English sort of fantasy looks like of King Arthur's world. The costumes are similarly, like, the king and queen have these weird halo crowns that are just beautifully weird and off kilter, and that's not necessarily what King Arthur looked, but who knows what he looked like. We don't know. I loved the sort of audacity of the whole thing. You know, you can take any meaning from it and any comfort from it. There's all sorts of messages in it that I found it weirdly comforting, the messaging I was getting from it. And I sort of saw a likeness with Sound of Metal in the hero's journey somehow, this idea of becoming worthy of yourself and becoming the man you want to be. And how you achieve that is acceptance of yourself. And so I loved it. I thought it was an amazing film. And this is everything I hate on paper. I mean, giants, fantasy, you know, like all of this stuff. I hate this stuff. Yeah. So when I had to sit down and watch this, I was like, I will hate this. You know, it's just not for me. And it absolutely spirited me away. I adored it.
I think the ending was the thing that kind of really sold me on the whole vision for the movie. And made the whole journey really worthwhile, because, you know, as you're alluding to in the hero's journey, and it just does it in a very, I found it unexpected way, when it kind of does it in a way that's like unexpected, but still ties it all up in a really neat bow that is like everything just clicks into place. And sometimes doing something as, I guess, borderline risky is what this does. You know, sometimes it really doesn't pay off, but I really found here that it just worked and really elevated everything we had seen beforehand. And so I'm surprised that Matthew Leyland didn't like it as much.
Yeah. And it's a Christmas movie as well. Normally I'm down with a Christmas movie.
It is, yeah. And it's apt that it should be so high on our end of year list, considering it is an end of year film. Well, Matthew's in the wrong, and that's all we have to say about that. Green Knight is at number two. Perhaps number one is more your taste, Matthew, because you did vote in this, and I wonder if you voted for this one. It's finally time for our number one. It's our film of the year, and Total Film's movie of 2021 is this.
Fear is the mind killer.
My Lord Duke.
Where the fear is gone, only I will remain.
Go, go, go!
Okay, so this is Dune, Denis Villeneuve's long anticipated adaptation of that book that all the nerds at school used to read. Matt, what was this doing right that our previous version did not?
I must say straight off the bat, I haven't actually ever read Dune, Frank Herbert's novel that this is based on. I've taken a couple of runs at it, but never managed to get more than sort of 30 pages in. So I was almost a bit dubious going into this film. I know Denis Villeneuve's a huge fan, but I was kind of immediately won over right from the beginning, where you get this blast of sort of disturbing voiceover in a strange language that I believe it says dreams are messages from the deep. And so instantly I was like, oh my God, like, what is this? And then to sort of fall back on a cliche, and again, something I've said, you know, probably bored people saying this several times over this year, but is I kind of compare it to the Lord of the Rings films in the sense that this is probably the first time since then that I felt truly transported to another sort of time and place. And the world building is just is just sort of absolutely incredible here. We're in the far-flung future of our own world, but very far off into the future. And we're following kind of House Atreides, led by Oscar Isaac's Duke Leto. And he's basically just been given control of this desert planet Arrakis, where spice is harvested. And spice is like one of the most kind of valuable and important substances in this world, because it's used for various means, including kind of interstellar travel. And you've got all these kind of political machinations of what's going on, because the Harkonnens, who were the sort of house who were previously in charge of Arrakis, are obviously a bit unhappy to be booted off this lucrative, you know, planet. And there's lots of other weirdness going on. The Duke's son, Paul, who's the lead character played by Timothy Chalamet, he's believed to possibly be this sort of messiah type figure who, you know, might end up, you know, changing the world. So there's all this going on, but then at the same time, you just kind of utterly believe where you are. I know sometimes people complain about the fact that it's, you know, it's very serious and there's not really much humor in it, but I sort of feel like it needed that in a way, because it just totally cares about its world and it believes in its own world. It's not kind of doesn't laugh at it. It just takes it completely seriously. And I just felt like completely transported for that time. And then once you then factor in just the kind of the harsh Arrakis environment, like this kind of desert environment that's unfamiliar to, you know, these people who've just moved there, you've got these giant blooming sandworms as well that are kind of, you know, causing havoc and got to be looked out for. There's the sort of the Fremen, which are the sort of people who kind of live natively on Arrakis. And so there's the kind of tension between them and the newcomers. There's loads going on. It's a very sort of dense film, 2.5 hours, and it crams a lot into that time.
But not all of it, Matt. This is some people's complaints, that only half the book is this film. Even in that 2.5 hours, only half the book. Why is it satisfying even when it finishes halfway?
For me, I think they just about got away with it. Obviously, I would have been like, now we know it's, you know, part two has been confirmed. They're going to start working on that soon. You know, it's been greenlit. But when I first finished watching this, I was like, oh, it will be like an absolute travesty if it didn't end up making enough money to warrant the sequel. So I would have been gutted not to see Denis Villeneuve kind of complete this. But I think they just about reach a point where it does work as a sort of single film, because you reach a point in Paul's story where he's, you know, he's moved on from one aspect to the next, that there, you know, there is a bit of kind of closure there. There's obviously the hint of much more to come, but you've sort of seen enough, I think, to have like, you haven't got a satisfying moment. It's not like you're suddenly just like, well, what, it's finished? Like, I don't know, I felt there was enough there. What about you guys?
I think the first 2 hours are like phenomenal. You know, you're right, the world building, everything about it. And I also tried a long time ago to read the book and struggled and gave up, and there were just so many names and places that I just had no understanding of. So I just kind of, yeah, just like, I'm not doing this, putting that to the side. I mean, even when you were saying them there, like Atreides and Harkonnen, I'm just like, oh man,
Fremen.
This is, yeah. I mean, this is like Lord of the Rings is like my favorite movie, and there's a lot of names in there, but here it's just, I don't know, there's something about it. Anyway, but this is the thing, Denny kind of like, he does it in a way that makes it very straightforward, understandable, puts the emphasis very much on kind of Timothy's character, Paul, and the hero journey there and the chosen one and kind of the mythology around there with his mum and that cult and all that. And so it really pulls it all together and keeps it very tight, I found. You know, it could have really gone into all the politics and everything like that, but it doesn't. It kind of restrains itself, and it has really good action in it. You know, we see planets being invaded, and there's one scene when they kind of go out on this like fly helicopter-y thing, and they go look at where they're collecting the spice. And
there's an incident with a worm.
Yeah, isn't it? And it's just like, it's a tense, great action, and it makes it, you know, a real cinematic event. I mean, I think the split into two parts, I'm almost wish it had been split into three and had finished slightly earlier, because I do think like when we kind of meet Zendaya and that lot, there's like almost slightly too much of it where you need more to make it feel like complete in that section. So I almost sort of like to just like cut there, had even more of this world, because I think it just does such a good job of getting you absorbed in it. I mean, I saw this on the IMAX, and the cinematography is just mind blowing. Yeah. It's stunning.
I mean, cinematography, the sound design, the you know, the score, the costumes, the production design. This is like proper filmmaking right here, isn't it? This is the sort of film that we've been waiting for that says this is resolutely cinema. This isn't something, this is not a Red Notice that's going to just pop up on Netflix. This is a big screen.
Nothing wrong with Red Notice.
Well, there is, Matthew, and that's another conversation. But I think the reason this has probably made our number one is it's just so resolutely cinematic in every aspect of it. And even if you didn't love it entirely, it's a really impressive feat to have condensed that incredibly dense book down to something that's propulsive and leaves you wanting more. That's quite an achievement, isn't it?
I think it feels like just proper cinema. I mean, you know, even though it's part of like obviously a bigger Dune franchise and built on a property, well, I guess, you know, the books, and it's a remake of a not so great film and all this, it still feels like its own thing that isn't necessarily setting up like a million spin-offs. You know, it's not like a Marvel
not
movie
a universe.
Yeah, you don't need to watch like 20 films to understand it or anything. It is just what it is and works on its own. And it feels like we haven't had a big movie adventure that's of this scale like this for such a long time. And I think even the fact that people were nervous about there not being a Dune Part 2 kind of speaks to that as well. That, like, you know, the chances that there wasn't going to be one means that they're not necessarily going like, here's a mega franchise straight out the gate. It is like, we're actually going to build this properly on the foundation of like just one really, really awesome movie. You know, I wish that we had more big blockbusters that felt like this and had this scope and ambition.
Can you imagine if Kevin Feige came out and said, well, there might not be another Avengers movie. I don't know. Depends how this one does, you know, if you guys like it, but who knows?
Yeah, there is something really, it feels exciting to see a film that has just been done for just the one shot and that nobody was doing it with any other intention in sight. This is a endeavor that's been crafted with great love, and they've left everything on the field for this. And, you know, there was no keeping something back for something else. This was it. And if it didn't work, then this was literally all you got. There's something really intoxicating about that, isn't there?
Yeah, and just again, just a ridiculous cast across the board. Because we mentioned Timothy, Zendaya, obviously both great actors, but then Rebecca Ferguson, possibly the best she's ever been in this. Oscar Isaac, Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, Jason Momoa,
Charlotte Rampling,
Javier Bardem. You know, it's just literally just a ridiculous cast. Like, ridiculous.
Ridiculous. And The Worm, yes. Let's not forget The Worm. Magnificent Worm. Performance from The Worm. So from that, we will say that is our number one film of the year. Let us know if you agree or disagree with our top 10. But Dune is our number one that we insist you go and see if you want to be friends with us. So that is Dune. Yeah. So those are our best. But just quickly, I guess we should just talk about our turkeys of the year as well. You know, Dune was our best, but Matt, what was your worst?
Okay, if I can dive in on my worst, and I'm going to pick this one because I know some people actually, well, some people said they liked this film, but it hasn't come up in any end of year list that I've seen. But Old, I'm going to choose as my personal turkey of the year because I just thought this was absolutely terrible. Like, I reviewed it for Total Film and I was on the 2-star, 1-star border, and I kind of gave it the benefit of the doubt because it is a great idea and a kind of great setup. But I thought this film was just appalling and it was just terribly acted, and people only seem to enjoy it because they were sort of laughing at it. If you actually sort of treated it with the seriousness with which it seemingly takes itself, it's just terrible. It's just terrible acting, silly, stupid, nonsensical. Like, I actually kind of laughed unintentionally funny frequently. You know, I just thought this was terrible, with the obligatory bad M. Night Shyamalan cameo as well. So that's my turkey of the year. It's Old.
My least favorite movie of the year was probably Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City. And it's because I like love the Resident Evil games, and they did a really great job of like recreating the like places, but the actual story, it's just like such a mess of a movie. Yeah, it just annoyed me because I feel like there is a great adaptation waiting to be done. And this was like the only chance, right? Like, we've done this series once before. with Paul W.A. Anderson and Mia Djokovic. Like, if we're going to do it again, and it's like based heavily on the games, which again, like, could have been a really interesting idea. It feels like we've used up our one chance. We're going to put this to bed for another like 20 years and then come back. Hopefully someone will do it justice. But yeah, so it frustrated me on a number of levels. Annoyingly, I interviewed the director for online and he was really nice and lovely. And we nerded out about the movie and like the references and stuff, because you can do that. But the movie itself was not my favourite. Let's put it that way.
Matthew Leyland, your turkey of the year.
God, it's a big choice, isn't it? There's so many. I have to say I didn't like The Last Duel. I was very disappointed with that. I expected a lot more from Ridley Scott, but I felt like that left quite a bad taste watching that. These very boring men and this one female character being sexually harassed for 2.5 hours. It's just not a pleasant watch.
Why have one rape when you can have two? Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it sort of tried to make itself out to be a feminist film, but it really did not come off like that. So,
no, I agree with you on that.
Blythe Spirit, I thought, was pretty dreadful as well. That's like a case of really good source material, really good cast, and they somehow ballsed it up completely. Really hopelessly unfunny, poor, boring. Yeah, not a fan of that. And then probably a film neither of you saw, but I sat through, called Monster Family 2, which was just
a wretched
piece of animation.
Wretched.
Yeah, I don't imagine many people did. Yeah.
Great.
And I just absolutely beef with, there's a scene with a family in a car. None of them are wearing seatbelts and there's no explanation for it. And they're kind of rolling around in the seats. And I just thought that was shocking and very irresponsible. So.
Yeah, if you're thinking about seatbelts whilst you're watching a family animation film, you're probably not being entertained, are you? My turkey of the year was Reminiscence, the Lisa Joy film with Hugh Jackman playing some sort of private detective in a futuristic world where the world is too hot to live in the day. So you have to skulk around at night and it's all a bit soggy and he can make memories. And it had this voiceover that I immediately wanted to leave the cinema as like, memories are like pearls on a necklace. And it's just like, is this a comedy? And no, it wasn't. And it was, the dialogue was so unspeakably turgid. And I could not believe that Rebecca Ferguson, who is absolutely magnificent in Dune, was in this film in the same year. She's a wonderful actress and just dreadfully served here as a character and as an actress. Yeah, I think I might want to rewatch it, but like watch it as a comedy, because it was so bad it annoyed me the first time. But maybe I would be entertained if I just watched it from a hate watch point of view. And like, how has this been made? It's so dreadful, and the story makes no sense. And there's a sex scene that has sort of euphemism shots in it that is just like, are you serious? With an overflowing water thing that overflows at the point of climax.
Oh my goodness, what do you mean?
All of it was just too much. So that's my turkey for the year. Okay, so that is our best of the year and our worst of the year. We'll be back in the new year with new reviews of releases in 2022, which can't wait for. So many good things coming down the pipe next year. If you want to get all the information on all those films as they arrive next year, we've got a special listener offer of 3 issues of Total Film Magazine for only £3. £3, ladies and gentlemen, for 3 issues. Absolute bargain. To get this special offer, go to www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod and select your preferred subscription package. And if you do that, you get your magazine delivered to your door. You don't have to go down the shops. You never miss an issue and you pay less than you would in the shops. Plus, you'll get subscriber exclusive cover and content. I mean, why would you not do that, lads, right? Why would you not get the magazine just delivered to your home? Saves you all the hassle. We subscribe, don't we?
Oh, of course.
So yes, that web address again is www.magazinesdirect.com/InsidePod for 3 magazines for £3. What a Christmas treat. And on that note, it's time to go away and we'll see each other on the other side. So I'll bid you adieu. Say goodbye, boys.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. We'll see you next year.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and the days of old lang syne? For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness, yeah, for the sake of old lang syne. Sing it. For